Nadine.
It's better this way, Harold. Better for you. Because his way would be so much worse. You see that, don't you? You wouldn't want to meet him face to face, Harold. He feels that someone who would betray one side would probably betray the other. He'd kill you, but he'd drive you mad first. He has that power. He let me choose. This way or his way. I chose this. You can end it quickly if you're brave. You know what I mean. He checked the loads in the pistol for the first of hundreds, maybe thousands of times, keeping the gun in the shadowed hollow of one lacerated and shredded elbow. "What about you?" he called up. "Aren't you a betrayer, too?" Her voice was sad. "I never betrayed him in my heart." "I believe that's exactly where you did betray him," Harold called up to her. He tried to put a large expression of sincerity on his face, but he was actually calculating the distance. He would have two shots at the most, and a pistol was a notoriously chancy weapon. "And I believe he knows it." "He needs me," she said, "and I need him. You were never in it, Harold, and if we'd gone on together, I might have let you do something to me. That small thing, and that would have destroyed everything. I couldn't take the smallest chance that might happen after all the sacrifice and blood and nastiness. We sold our souls together, Harold, but there's enough of me left to want full value for mine."
"I'll give you full value," Harold said, and managed to get up on his knees.
The sun was dazzling. Vertigo seized him in rough hands, whirling the gyroscope balance inside his head. He seemed to hear voices, a voice, roaring in surprised protest. He pulled the trigger. The shot echoed, bounced back, was thrown from cliff face to cliff face, cracking and whacking and fading. Comical surprise spread over Nadine's face. Harold thought in a drunken kind of triumph. "She didn't think I had it in me." Her mouth hung open in a shocked round O. Her eyes were wide. The fingers of her hands tensed and flew up, as if she were about to play some abnormal tune on the piano. The moment was so sweet that he lost a second or two savoring it and not realizing that he had missed. When he did realize, he brought the pistol back down, trying to aim it, locking his right wrist with his left hand.
"Harold, no, you can't."
"Can't I? It's such a little thing squeezing a trigger. Sure I can." She seemed too shocked to move, and as the pistol's front sight came to rest in the hollow of her throat, he felt a sudden cold certainty that this was how it was meant to end. He had her dead in his sights. But as he started to pull the trigger, sweat ran into his eyes, doubling his vision. He began to slide. He later told himself that the loose gravel had given way, or that his mangled leg had buckled, or both. It might even have been true. But it felt like a push. And in the long nights between then and now, he had not been able to convince himself otherwise. The daytime Harold was stubbornly rational to the end. But in the night, the hideous certainty stole over him that in the end, it had been the dark man himself who had thwarted him. The shot went wild. High, wide, and handsome into the indifferent blue sky. Harold went rolling and tumbling back down to the dead tree, his right leg twisting and buckling, a huge sheet of agony from ankle to groin. He had passed out. When he came to again, it was just past dusk, and the moon, three-quarters full, was riding solemnly over the gorge. Nadine was gone. He spent that first night in a delirium of terror. When morning came, he began to crawl upward again, sweating and racked with pain. He began around 7 o'clock, just about the time the big orange burial crew trucks would be leaving the bus depot back in Boulder. He finally wrapped one raw and blistered hand around the guardrail cable at 5 o'clock that afternoon. His motorcycle was still there, and he nearly wept with relief. He dug some cans and the opener out of one of the saddlebags with frantic haste, opened one of the cans, and crammed cold corned beef hash into his mouth in double handfuls. But it tasted bad, and after a long struggle, he threw it up. He began to understand the irrefutable fact of his coming death then, and he lay beside the Triumph and wept, his twisted leg under him. After that, he was able to sleep a little. The following day he was drenched by a pounding rain shower that left him soaked and shivering. His leg had begun to smell of gangrene, and he took pains to keep the Colt Woodsman sheltered from the wet with his body. That evening he had begun to write in the permacover notebook, and discovered for the first time that his handwriting was beginning to regress. He wrote, "Are they all dead, I wonder? The committee? If so, I'm sorry. I was misled. That is a poor excuse for my actions, but I swear out of all I know that it is the only excuse that ever matters. The dark man is as real as the superflu itself, as real as the atomic bombs that still sit somewhere in their lead-lined closets. And when the end comes, and when it is as horrible as good men always knew it would be, there is only one thing to say as all those good men approach the throne of judgment. I was misled." Harold read what he had written and passed a thin and trembling hand over his brow. It wasn't a good excuse, it was a bad one. Pretty it up however you would, it still smelled. Someone who read that paragraph after reading his ledger would see him as a total hypocrite. He had seen himself as the king of anarchy, but the dark man had seen through him and had reduced him effortlessly to a shivering bag of bones, dying badly by the highway. He lay there with buzzards swooping and diving in the thermals overhead, trying to rationalize the unspeakable. He had fallen victim to his own protracted adolescence. It was as simple as that. He had been poisoned by his own lethal visions. Dying, he felt as if he had gained a little sanity, and maybe even a little dignity. He did not want to demean that with small excuses that came limping off the page in crutches. "I could have been something in Boulder," he said quietly. And the simple, awful truth of that might have brought tears if he hadn't been so tired and so dehydrated. He looked at the straggling letters on the page, and from there to the Colt. Suddenly he wanted it over, and he tried to think how to put a finish to his life in the truest, simplest way he could. It seemed more necessary than ever to write it and leave it for whoever might find him in 1 year or in 10. He gripped the pen, thought, wrote. "I apologize for the destructive things I have done, but do not deny that I did them of my own free will. On my school papers I always signed my name Harold Emery Lauder. I signed my manuscripts in the same way. God help me, I once wrote it on the roof of a barn in letters 3 feet high. I want to sign this by a name given me in Boulder. I could not accept it then, but I take it now freely. I'm going to die in my right mind." Writing neatly at the bottom, he affixed his signature, Hawk. He put the permacover notebook into the Triumph's saddlebag. He capped the pen and clipped it in his pocket. He put the muzzle of the Colt into his mouth and looked up at the blue sky. He thought of a game they had played when they were children, a game the others had teased him about because he had never quite dared to go through with it. There was a gravel pit out on one of the back roads, and you could jump off the ledge and fall a heart-stopping distance before hitting the sand, rolling over and over, and finally jumping up to do it all over again. All except Harold. Harold would stand on the lip of the drop and chant, 1, 2, 3, just like the others, but the talisman never worked. His legs remained locked. He could not bring himself to jump. And the others sometimes chased him home, shouting at him, calling him Harold the Pansy. He thought, if I could have brought myself to jump, once, just once, I might not be here. Well, last time pays for all. He thought, 1, 2, 3. He pulled the trigger. The gun went off. Harold jumped. Chapter 55. North of Las Vegas is Emigrant Valley, and that night a small spark of fire glowed in its tumbled wilderness. Randall Flagg sat beside it, moodily cooking the carcass of a small rabbit. He turned it steadily on the crude rotisserie he had made, watching it sizzle and spit grease into the fire. There was a light breeze, blowing the savory smell out into the desert, and the wolves had come. They sat two rises over from his fire, howling at the nearly full moon and at the smell of cooking meat. Every now and then he would glance at them, and two or three would begin to fight, biting and snapping and kicking with their powerful back legs until the weakest was banished. Then the others would begin to howl again, their snouts pointed at the bloated, reddish moon. But the wolves bored him now. He wore his jeans and his boots and his sheepskin jacket with its two buttons. The night wind flapped fitfully at his collar. He didn't like the way things were going. There were bad omens in the wind, evil portents like bats fluttering in the dark loft of a deserted barn. The old woman had died, and at first he had thought that was good. In spite of everything, he had been afraid of the old woman. She had died, and he had told Dana Jurgens that she had died in a coma. But was it true? He was no longer sure. Had she talked at the end? And if so, what had she said? What were they planning? He had developed a sort of third eye. It was like the levitating ability, something he had and accepted, but which she didn't really understand. He was able to send it out to see, almost always. But sometimes the eye fell mysteriously blind. He had been able to look into the old woman's death chamber, had seen them gathered around her, their tail feathers still singed from Harold and Nadine's little surprise. But then the vision had faded away, and he had been back in the desert, wrapped in his bedroll, looking up and seeing nothing but Cassiopeia in her starry rocking chair. And there had been a voice inside him that said, "She's gone." They waited for her to talk, but she never did. But he no longer trusted the voice. There was the troubling matter of the spies. The judge with his head blown off. The girl who had eluded him at the last second. And she had known, God damn it, she had known. He threw a sudden furious stare at the wolves, and nearly half a dozen fell to fighting, their guttural sounds like ripping cloth in the stillness. He knew all their secrets except the third. Who was the third? He had sent the eye out over and over again, and it afforded him with nothing but the cryptic, idiotic face of the moon. M-O-O-N, that spells moon. Who was the third? How had the girl been able to escape him? He had been taken utterly by surprise, left with nothing but a handful of her blouse. He had known about her knife, that had been child's play, but not about that sudden leap at the window wall, and the cold-blooded way she had taken her own life without a moment's hesitation. His thoughts chased each other like weasels in the dark. Things were getting just a trifle flaky around the edges. He didn't like it. Lauder, for instance. There was Lauder. He had performed so excellently, like one of those little wind-up toys with a key sticking out of its back. Go here, go there, do this, do that. But the dynamite bomb had only gotten two of them. All that planning, all that effort spoiled by that dying old nigger woman's return. And then, after Harold had been disposed of, he had nearly killed Nadine. He still felt a burst of amazed anger when he thought about it. And the dumb cunt had stood there with her mouth hanging open, waiting for him to do it again, almost as if she wanted to be killed. And who was going to end up with all this if Nadine died? Who, if not his son? The rabbit was done. He slipped it off the spit and onto his tin plate. All right, all you asshole gyrenes, chow down. That made him grin. Had he been a Marine once? He thought so. Strictly the Paris Island variety, he thought. There had been a kid, a defective named Boo Dinkway. They had... what? Flag frowned down at his mess kit. Had they beaten old Boo into the ground with those padded poles? Scragged him somehow? He seemed to remember something about gasoline. But what? In a sudden rage, he almost slung the freshly cooked rabbit into the fire. He should be able to remember that, goddammit. "Chow down, grunts," he whispered. But this time there was only a whiff of memory lane. He was losing himself. Once he had been able to look back over the 60s and 70s like a man looking down a double flight of stairs leading into a darkened room. Now he could only clearly remember the events since the superflu. Beyond that, nothing but a haze that would sometimes lift a tiny bit, just enough to afford a glimpse of some enigmatic object or memory. Boo Dinkway, for instance, if there ever had been such a person, before closing down again. The earliest memory he could now be sure of was walking south on U.S. 51, heading toward Mountain City and the home of Kit Bradenton. He was no longer strictly a man, if he had ever been one. He was like an onion, slowly peeling away one layer at a time, only it was the trappings of humanity that seemed to be peeling away. Organized reflection, memory, possibly even free will, if there ever had been such a thing. He began to eat the rabbit. Once he was quite sure he would have done a quick fade when things began to get flaky. Not this time. This was his place, his time, and he would take his stand here. It didn't matter if he hadn't yet been able to uncover the third spy, or that Harold had gotten out of control at the end and had had the colossal effrontery to try to kill the bride who had been promised, the mother of his son. Somewhere that strange trash can man was in the desert, sniffing out the weapons that would eradicate the troublesome, worrisome free zone people forever. His eye could not follow the trash can man, and in some ways Flagg thought that Trash was stranger than he was himself, a kind of human bloodhound who sniffed cordite and napalm and gelignite with deadly radar accuracy. In a month or less, the National Guard jets would be flying, with a full complement of Shrike missiles tucked under their wings. And when he was sure that the bride had conceived, they would fly east. He looked dreamily up at the basketball moon and smiled. There was one other possibility. He thought the eye would show him in time. He might go there, possibly as a crow, possibly as a wolf, possibly as an insect, a praying mantis, perhaps, something small enough to squirm through a carefully concealed vent cap in the middle of a spiky patch of desert grass. He would hop or crawl through dark conduits and finally slip through an air conditioner grill or a stilled exhaust fan. The place was underground, just over the border and into California. There were beakers there, rows and rows of beakers, each with its own neat dymo tape identifying it. A super cholera, a super anthrax, a new and improved version of the bubonic plague, all of them based on the shifting antigen ability that had made the superflu so almost universally deadly. There were hundreds of them in this place, assorted flavors, as they used to say in the Lifesavers commercials. How about a little in your water, free zone? How about a nice airburst? Some lovely Legionnaire's disease for Christmas? Randy Flagg, the Black Santa, in his National Guard sleigh, with a little virus to drop down every chimney. He would wait, and he would know at the right time. No quick fade this time. He was on top, and he was going to stay there. The rabbit was gone. Full of hot food, he felt himself again. He stood, tin plate in hand, and slung the bones out into the night. The wolves charged at them, fought over them, growling and biting and snarling, their eyes rolling blankly in the moonlight. Flagg stood, hands on his hips, and roared laughter up at the moon. Early the next morning, Nadine headed down I-15 again on her Vespa. Her snow-white hair, unbound, trailed out behind her, looking very much like a bridal train. She felt sorry for the Vespa, which had served her so long and faithfully, and which was now dying. Mileage and desert heat, the laborious crossing of the Rockies, and indifferent maintenance had all taken their toll. The engine now sounded hoarse and laboring. The RPM needle had begun to shudder instead of remaining docilely against the 5x1,000 figure. It didn't matter. If it died on her before she arrived, she would walk. No one was chasing her now. Harold was dead. And if she had to walk, he would know and send someone out to pick her up. Harold had shot at her. Harold had tried to kill her. Her mind kept returning to that, no matter how she tried to avoid it. Her mind worried it like a dog worries a bone. It wasn't supposed to be that way. Flagg had come to her in a dream that first night after the explosion, when Harold finally allowed them to camp. He told her he was going to leave Harold with her until the two of them were almost into Utah. Then he would be removed in a quick, painless accident. But it hadn't been quick and painless, and Harold had almost killed her. The bullet had droned past within an inch of her cheek, and still she had been unable to move. She had been frozen in shock, wondering how he could have done such a thing, how he could have been allowed to even try such a thing. She had tried to tell herself it was Flagg's way of throwing a scare into her, but it made no sense. It was crazy. Even if it had made some sort of sense, there was a firm, knowing voice inside her which said the shooting incident had just been something Flagg had not been prepared against. She tried to push the voice away, to bar the door against it the way a sane person will bar the door against an undesirable person with murder in his or her eyes. But she couldn't do it. The voice told her she was alive through blind chance now, that Harold's bullet could just as easily have gone between her eyes. She called the voice a liar. Flagg knew everything, where the smallest sparrow had fallen. "No, that's God," the voice replied implacably. "God, he's not. You're alive through blind chance, and that means that all bets are off. You owe him nothing. You can turn around and go back if you want to." Go back, that was a laugh. The voice had little to say on that subject. She would have been surprised if it did. If the dark man's feet were made of clay, she had discovered the fact just a little late. She tried to concentrate on the cool beauty of the desert morning instead of the voice, but the voice remained low and insistent. "He didn't know Harold was going to try to kill you. What else doesn't he know? And will it be a clean miss next time?" But, oh dear God, it was too late, by days and weeks and even years. Why had that voice waited until it was useless to speak up? And as if in agreement, the voice finally fell silent, and she had the morning to herself. She rode without thinking, her eyes fixed on the road unreeling in front of her. The road that led to Las Vegas. The road that led to him. The Vespa died that afternoon. There was a grinding clank deep in its guts, and the engine stalled. She could smell something hot and abnormal, like frying rubber, drifting up from the engine case. Her speed had dropped from the steady 40 she had been maintaining until she had been putting along at walking speed. Now she trundled it over into the breakdown lane and cranked the starter a few times, knowing it was useless. She had killed it. She had killed a lot of things on her way to her husband. She had been responsible for wiping out the entire Free Zone committee and all of their invited guests to that final explosive meeting. And then there was Harold. Also, say hey, and by the way, let's not forget Fran Goldsmith's unborn baby. That made her feel sick. She stumbled over to the guardrail and tossed up her light lunch. She felt hot, sick, and delirious, the only living thing in a sun-struck desert nightmare. It was hot. So hot. She turned back, wiping her mouth. The Vespa lay on its side like a dead animal. Nadine looked at it for a few moments, and then began to walk. She had already passed Dry Lake. That meant she would have to sleep by the road tonight if no one picked her up. With any luck, she would reach Las Vegas in the morning. And suddenly she was sure that the dark man would let her walk. She would reach Las Vegas hungry and thirsty and burning with the desert heat, every last bit of the old life flushed from her system. The woman who had taught small children at a private school in New England would be gone, as dead as Napoleon. She walked, and the afternoon advanced. Sweat rolled down her face. Quicksilver glimmered, always at the point where the highway met the faded denim sky. She unbuttoned her light blouse and took it off, walking in her white cotton bra. Sunburn? So what? Frankly, my dear, I don't give a fuck. By dusk she had gone a terrible shade of red that was nearly purple along the raised edges of her collarbones. The cool of the evening came suddenly, making her shiver, and making her remember that she had left her camping gear with the Vespa. She looked around doubtfully, seeing cars here and there, some of them buried in drifting sand up to their hood ornaments. The thought of sheltering in one of those tombs made her feel sick, even sicker than her terrible sunburn was making her feel. She decided she would walk all night rather than sleep in one of those cars. If this were only the Midwest again, she could have found a barn, a haystack, a field of clover, a clean, soft place. Out here there was only the road, the sand, the baked hard pan of the desert. She brushed her long hair away from her face and dully realized that she wished she were dead. Now the sun was below the horizon, the day perfectly poised between light and dark. The wind that now slipped over her was dead cold. She looked around herself, suddenly afraid. It was too cold. The buttes had become dark monoliths. The sand dunes were like ominous toppled colossi. Even the spiny stands of Saguro were like the skeletal fingers of the accusing dead, poking up out of the sand from their shallow graves. Overhead, the cosmic wheel of the sky. A snatch of lyric occurred to her, an eagle song, suddenly frightening. "And I want to sleep with you in the desert tonight, with a million stars all around." Suddenly she knew he was there, even before he spoke. Nadine. His soft voice, coming out of the growing darkness, infinitely soft, the final enveloping terror that was like coming home. "Nadine, Nadine, how I love to love Nadine." She turned around, and there he was, as she had always known he would be someday. He was sitting on the hood of an old Chevrolet sedan, his legs crossed, his hands laid gently on the knees of his faded jeans, looking at her and smiling gently. But his eyes were not gentle at all. They gave lie to the idea that this man felt anything gentle. In them she saw a black lee that danced endlessly like the legs of a man fresh through the trap door in a gibbet platform. "Hello," she said. "I'm here." "Yes. At last you are here, as promised." His smile broadened, and he held his hands out to her. She took them, and as she reached him, she felt his baking heat. He radiated it like a well-stoked brick oven. His smooth, lineless hands slipped around hers, and then closed over them tight like handcuffs. "Oh, Nadine," he whispered, and bent to kiss her. She turned her head just a little, looking up at the cold fire of the stars, and his kiss was on the hollow below her jaw rather than on her lips. He wasn't fooled. She felt the mocking curve of his grin against her flesh. "He revolts me," she thought. But revulsion was only a scaly crust over something worse, a caked and long-hidden lust, an ageless pimple finally brought to a head and about to spew forth some noisome fluid, some sweetness long since curdled. His hands, slipping over her back, were much hotter than her sunburn. She moved against him, and suddenly the slim saddle between her legs seemed plumper, fuller, more tender, more aware. The seam of her slacks was chafing her in a delicately obscene way that made her want to rub herself, get rid of the itch, cure it once and for all. "Tell me one thing," she said. "Anything." "You said, as promised. Who promised me to you? Why me? And what do I call you? I don't even know that. I've known about you for most of my life, and I don't know what to call you." "Call me Richard. That's my real name. Call me that." "Richard?" she asked doubtfully, and he giggled against her neck, making her skin crawl with loathing and desire. "And who promised me?" "Nadine," he said. "I have forgotten. Come on." He slipped off the hood of the car, still holding her hands, and she almost jerked them away and ran. But what good would that have done? He would only chase after her, catch her, rape her. "The moon," he said. "It's full. And so am I." He brought her hand down to the smooth and faded crotch of his jeans, and there was something terrible there, beating with a life of its own beneath the notched coldness of his zipper. "No," she muttered, and tried to pull her hand away, thinking how far this was from that other moon-struck night, how impossibly far. This was at the other end of time's rainbow. He held her hand against him. "Come out in the desert and be my wife," he said.
"No."
"It's much too late to say no, dear." She went with him. There was a bedroll and the blackened bones of a campfire under the silver skull of the moon. He laid her down. "All right," he breathed. His fingers worked his belt buckle, then the button, then the zipper. She saw what he had and began to scream. His grin sprang forth at the sound, huge and glittering and obscene in the night, and the moon stared down blankly, bloated and cheesy. Nadine peeled forth scream after scream and tried to crawl away, and he grabbed her, and then she was holding her leg shut with all her strength, and when one of those blank hands inserted itself between them, they parted like water, and she thought, "I will look up. I will look up at the moon. I will feel nothing, and it will be over. It will be over. I will feel nothing." And when the dead coldness of him slipped into her, the shriek ripped up and out of her, bolted free, and she struggled, and the struggle was useless. He battered into her, invader, destroyer, and the cold blood gushed down her thighs, and then he was in her, all the way up to her womb, and the moon was in her eyes, cold and silver fire. And when he came, it was like molten iron, molten pig iron, molten brass, and she came herself, came in screaming, incredible pleasure, came in terror, in horror, passing through the pig iron and brass gates into the desert land of insanity, chased through, blown through like a leaf by the bellowing of his laughter, watching his face melt away. And now it was the shaggy face of a demon lolling just above her face, a demon with glaring yellow lamps for eyes, windows into a hell never even considered. And still there was that awful good humor in them, eyes that had watched down the crooked alleys of 1,000 tenebrous night towns. Those eyes were glaring and glinting and finally stupid. He went again, and again, and again. It seemed he would never be used up. Cold. He was dead cold. And old. Older than mankind, older than the earth. Again and again he filled her with his night spawn, screaming laughter. Earth, light, coming, coming again. The last shriek coming out of her to be wiped away by the desert wind and carried into the furthest chambers of the night, out to where 1,000 weapons waited for their new owner to come and claim them. Shaggy demon's head, a lolling tongue deeply split into two forks. Its dead breath fell on her face. She was in the land of insanity now. The iron gates were closed. The moon. The moon was almost down. He had caught another rabbit, had caught the trembling little thing in his bare hands and had broken its neck. He had built a new fire on the bones of the old one, and now the rabbit cooked, sending up savory ribbons of aroma. There were no wolves now. It was, after all, his wedding night. And the dazed and apathetic thing sitting lumpishly on the other side of the fire was his blushing bride. He leaned over and raised her hand out of her lap. When he let it go, it stayed in place, raised to the level of her mouth. He looked at this phenomena for a moment, and then put her hand back in her lap. He poked two fingers at her eyes, and she did not blink. That blank stare just went on and on. He was honestly puzzled. What had he done to her? He couldn't remember. And it didn't matter. She was pregnant. If she was also catatonic, what did that matter? She was the perfect incubator. She would breed his son, bear him, and then she could die with her purpose served. After all, it was what she was there for. The rabbit was done. He broke it in two. He pulled her half into tiny pieces, the way you break up a baby's food. He fed it to her a piece at a time. Some pieces fell out of her mouth, half-chewed, but she ate most of it. If she remained like this, she would need a nurse. Jenny Engstrom, perhaps. "That was very good, dear," he said softly. She looked blankly up at the moon. Flag smiled gently at her and at his wedding supper. Good sex always made him hungry. He awoke in the latter part of the night and sat up in his bedroll, confused and afraid. Afraid in the instinctive, unknowing way that an animal is afraid, a predator who senses that he himself may be being stalked. Had it been a dream? A vision? They're coming. Frightened, he tried to understand the thought, to put it in some context. He couldn't. It hung there on its own like a bad hex. They're closer now. Who? Who was closer now? The night wind whispered past him, seeming to bring him a scent. Someone was coming and... someone's going. While he slept, someone had passed his camp, headed east. The unseen third? He didn't know. It was the night of the full moon. Had the third escaped? The thought brought panic with it. Yes, but who's coming? Nadine was asleep, pulled up in a tight fetal position, the position his son would assume in her belly only months from now. Are there months? Again, there was that feeling of things going flaky around the edges. He lay down again, believing there would be no more sleep for him this night. But he did sleep. And by the time he drove into Vegas the next morning, he was smiling again, and he had nearly forgotten his night panic. Nadine sat docilely beside him on the seat, a big doll with a seed hidden carefully in its belly. He went to the Grand, and there he learned what had happened while he slept. He saw the new look in their eyes, wary and questioning, and he felt the fear touch him again with its light moth wings. Chapter 56. At about the same time that Flagg was consummating his infernal marriage to Nadine Cross, Lloyd Henreid was sitting alone in the Cub Bar, playing big clock solitaire and cheating. He was out of temper. There had been a flash fire at Indian Springs that day, one dead, three hurt, and one of those likely to die of bad flash burns. Carl Huff had brought the news. He had been pissed off to a high extreme, and he was not a man to be taken lightly. He had been a pilot for Ozark Airlines before the plague, was an ex-marine, and he could have broken Lloyd in two pieces with one hand while mixing a daiquiri with the other if he had wanted to. Not that Lloyd was physically afraid of Carl. The pilot was big and tough, but he was as leery of the walkin' dude as anyone else in the West, and Lloyd wore Flagg's charm. But he was one of their flyers, and because he was, he had to be handled diplomatically. And oddly enough, Lloyd was something of a diplomat. His credentials were simple but awesome. He had spent several weeks with a certain madman named Poke Waxman, and had lived to tell the tale. He had also spent several months with Randall Flagg, and was still drawing air and in his right mind. Carl had come in around 2 on September 12th, his cycle helmet under one arm. There was an ugly burn on his left cheek and blisters on one hand. There had been a fire. Bad, but not as bad as it could have been. A fuel truck had exploded, spewing burning petroleum all over the tarmac area. "I don't think Freddy Campanari is going to live to see the sun go down. That leaves two pilots, me and Andy. Tell him that and tell him something else when he gets back. I want that fuck trash can man gone. That's my price for staying." Lloyd gazed at Carl Huff. "Is it? You're damn well told." "Well, I tell you, Carl," Lloyd said, "I can't pass that message on. If you want to give orders to him, you'll have to do it yourself." Carl looked suddenly confused and a little afraid, and fear sat strangely on that craggy face. "Yeah, I see your point. I'm fucked over, Lloyd. My face hurts like hell. I don't mean to take it out on you." "That's okay, man. It's what I'm here for." Sometimes he wished it wasn't. Already his head was starting to ache. Carl said, "But he's got to go. If I have to tell him that, I will. I know he's got one of those black stones. He's ace high with the big man, I guess. But hey, listen." Carl sat down and put his helmet on a baccarat table. "Trash was responsible for that fire. My Christ, how are we ever going to get those planes up if one of the big guy's men is torching the fucking pilots?" Several people passing through the lobby of the Grand glanced uneasily over at the table where Lloyd and Carl sat. "Keep your voice down, Carl." "Okay. But you see the problem, don't you?" "How sure are you the trash did it?" He was in the motor pool. Lots of guys saw him, including me. I thought he was out someplace in the desert. He came back. That sand crawler he takes out was full of stuff. God knows where he gets it. Well, he had the guys in stitches at coffee break. You know how he is. To him, weaponry is like candy is to a kid. The last thing he showed us was one of those incendiary fuses. You pull the tab, and there's this little burst of phosphorus. There's nothing for half an hour or 40 minutes, depending on the size of the fuse. Then there's one hell of a fire, small but very intense. Yeah? So Trashy was just drooling over it, and Freddy Campanari says, "Hey, people who play with fire wet the bed, Trash." And Steve Tobin, you know him, he's funny like a screen door in a submarine, he says, "You guys better put away your matches. Trashy's back in town." And Trash got really weird. He looked around at us, and he muttered under his breath. I was sitting right next to him, and it sounded like he said, "Don't ask me about old Lady Semple's check no more." That make any sense to you? Lloyd shook his head. Then he just left, picked up the stuff he was showing us, and took off. Well, none of us felt very good about it. We didn't mean to hurt his feelings. Most of the guys really like Trash. Or they did. He's like a little kid. An hour later, that fuel truck goes up like a rocket. And while we were picking up the pieces, I happened to look up, and there's Trashy over in the sand crawler by the barracks building, watching us with binoculars. "Is that all you've got?" Lloyd asked, relieved. "No, but it got me thinking about how that truck went up. That's just the sort of thing you use an incendiary fuse for. In Nam, the Kong blew up a lot of our ammo dumps just that way, with our own fucking incendiary fuses. The only thing that didn't fit was there's always a dozen fuel trucks in the motor pool, and we don't use them in any particular order. So after we got poor old Freddy over to the infirmary, John Waits and I went over there. John's in charge of the motor pool, and he was just about pissing himself. He'd seen Trash in there earlier. He was sure it was Trash Can Man? With those burns all the way up his arm, it's kind of hard to make a mistake, wouldn't you say? No one thought anything of it then. He was just poking around, and that's his job, ain't it?" "Yes, I guess you'd have to say it is." So me and John start to look over the rest of the fuel trucks. And holy shit, there's an incendiary fuse in every one of them. He put them on the exhaust pipes just below the fuel tanks themselves. The reason the truck we were using went first was because the exhaust pipe got hot. But the others were getting ready. Two or three were starting to smoke. Some of the trucks were empty, but at least five of them were full of jet fuel. Another 10 minutes and we would have lost half the goddamn base. Oh, Jesus, Lloyd thought mournfully. Carl held up his blistered hand. "I got this pulling one of the hot ones. Now do you see why he's got to go?" Lloyd said, "Maybe someone stole those fuses out of the back of his sand crawler while he was taking a leak or something." Carl said patiently, "That's not how it happened. Someone hurt his feelings while he was showing off his toys, and he tried to burn us all up. He damn near succeeded. Something's got to be done, Lloyd." "All right, Carl." He spent the rest of the afternoon asking around about Trash. Had anyone seen him or know where he might be?